Accession number 28353, Reel 8.
Peter, I'm sorry, you were describing your new post.
Yes, and I was saying that it was an extremely sort of interesting job because it gave you a very broad perspective on what was going on across the command, all of its different units and functions and so forth, and of course gave you an insight as to what other air forces thought through these visits that we looked after, and quite often there'll be sort of two of those a week, sometimes more. And you heard the answers that the Commander-in-Chief gave to these people, so again it was a very broadening experience, and has been something of a feature of most of the ground tours that I did as a middle-ranking officer, in as much that none of them were ever what you would call a traditional desk officer's job, where you're focus was on a particular project, whether it be bringing the next generation of Harrier into service or planning the finances of the command or the deployment posture. So it was, my staff jobs have all tended to be very broad and therefore to a degree shallow but broad, and this was absolute sort of example of that. But really extremely interesting, and because of the breadth of knowledge that you derive from it, again very useful for the future. Although sometimes I regret really never having done a narrow focused staff appointment, because I think that too would have been useful in some respects, but it never came my way.
Throughout your career you never did one?
No, never. Because soon I'm going to be, if you like, beyond the time where you're going to be narrowly focused because of the rank and span of control, you're going to be broad. But at this stage, as a wing commander, you might have expected to do quite a narrow focus in the procurement executive or something of that nature, but that never came my way. But it was good in terms of breadth of knowledge of the service and the command as a whole. That lasted, I suppose, about a year, perhaps slightly less, I should think of a good year, working for Sir David Craig, or Lord Craig now, who was the Commander-in-Chief, when I suddenly got a phone call, would I come down and see the Commander-in-Chief, and I said yes, and that wasn't unusual because from time to time he would say, look, I'd like a particular slant for this visit or that visit and so forth. And walked into his office, and he said, I'd like you to become my PSO, personal staff officer. And which took me back slightly, because no one had suggested that that was what I was going off to do, but I think he had obviously needed a new one. The Air Secretary had sent him a few candidates, and he decided that perhaps on his own staff he'd got somebody that he'd rather have. So I went and worked for the last 9 months or so of Sir David Craig's time as the Commander-in-Chief, as his personal staff officer. And that again, as for the briefing and presentation team, was a very broad job, because every moment of every day there's something different. And I have grown to like those sort of staff appointments, in as much that sort of every 5 minutes somebody actually gives you a different priority, and you have to sort of ditch this and move on to that and then go back to this, and then somebody diverts you again and the telephone rings, and it's difficult to spend too long focused on one subject. Nevertheless, as a result, again, you tend to be fairly shallow in your knowledge, but broad in the knowledge, and I did enjoy it. And David Craig was an excellent man to work for. He had a very steady routine. You knew when time he would arrive in the morning, what time he would leave for lunch, what time he would be back, and so forth. So it was a very steady routine. He liked you to, if he did his speeches and things like that, he would like you to write the speech for him without a great deal of guidance. and then he would amend it when you'd submitted something. So he quite liked your first attempt, which he would then change, which was quite different to his successor, Sir Peter Harding, who would sit you down and rattle out what he wanted to say, expect you to remember it, and go and turn what he told you in words into words on paper. So quite a different style. But Sir David Craig was much more predictable in that respect, and a pleasure to work for.
Did you... you therefore were with Peter Harding as a PSO?
I was subsequent to David Craig, yes.
Well, so you
come on to that right. In a moment.
Okay.
In terms of issues that were going through the command at that stage, there was a lot going on the NATO side. And so a lot of one's time was taken up with the new structural changes within the Air Defence Organisation. Within the United Kingdom and UK Air. So probably more on the NATO side than there was on the national side. Things that were going on the national side, Heseltine was the then Secretary of State for Defence, and his new management strategy was all the sort of buzzwords, devolvement of budgetary responsibility and so forth, which I think the commands were very keen to have, albeit at that stage the devolvement was not nearly as great as it is now. There were other aspects of the new management strategy which I think were less appealing, and I do remember the Commander-in-Chief being summoned to the Secretary of State, and we briefed him up, we gave him a very good sort of detailed brief on new management strategy, and he was being asked to go and give his view as a Commander-in-Chief to Heseltine, and Heseltine kept him waiting for about 45 minutes in his outer office before he prepared to see him, gave him about 5 minutes and then said, right, thank you very much, leave, and then off. And I must say there were very few times when I saw Sir David Craig cross, but that was certainly one of them. He was very still loyal in a way, but he was very cross that he had travelled to London, spent 45 minutes outside this man's door, and dismissed in 5 minutes of conversation. But he was a real pleasure to work for, and I hope that we as an outer office team served him as well as we could. He was succeeded, as you say, by Sir Peter Harding, who was a different man, very much less predictable, and in some ways that was a bit confusing and disconcerting. In other ways it was actually quite invigorating, because here was a man who had great charisma, huge natural ability to stand on his feet and speak without notes and things of that nature, very polished and so forth. Totally unpredictable as to what time he would come into the office, what time he would go for lunch, whether he would go for lunch, what time he would go in the evening. So your day, you never knew quite where you were going to start and finish and in what direction you were going to go in. And whereas, for example, my predecessor as PSO to Sir David Craig said, and everything came in sort of folders, small folders. Everything was taken off file, the background papers, and put in a little folder with a clear cover, so that might be a letter which he had to sign off, but had the supporting papers in it as well. And so as you vetted these things and made sure they were prepared and added to them or whatever, thing that would grow in your out tray. And he said, take in about 2.5 to 3 inches worth at any one go, about every half an hour, 40 minutes or so. Clearly, since he hasn't got through what you gave him last time, then come out again. But by and large, he'll have got through most of that. So put the new lot on the desk, take the old lot away. He said, but whatever you do, always keep about 4 or 5 inches in your cupboard of long-term type things, so that if he ever runs out of work and starts thinking for himself, you've got some stuff to take into him. And by and large, that worked with Sir David Craig. Harding came bursting out one day, and said, right, I've finished that lot. He said, now what have you got in your cupboard? And I said, I beg your pardon. He said, oh, I know. He said, you've got some stuff in the cupboard, he said, that you keep as a banker to keep me quiet and things of that nature. So he, you know, that was the sort of the difference between the two people. And he was interesting to work for, but real chalk and cheese. And I think what I did learn very quickly was not to try and make the second man work the same way as the first man had done. And I spent 6 months with Sir Peter Harding before I went off from that to be a station commander. David Craig had talked to me about commanding a station because he had told me that I would go on to command a station after this tour, even though I got 6 months or so to run with his successor. And he had asked me which station would I like to command. He said, you can either go to Gütersloh and command the Harrier force there, he said, which would obviously be a good job because it would be a combination of the Harrier force in Germany and a Chinook squadron and a Puma squadron, I think, two support helicopter squadrons. Or, he said, you can go and do something different. And he said, frankly, I don't mind what you do, but you can do whichever you feel would be better for you. And I decided that actually, though I would love to go back and command Gütersloh, that it was right that I actually went and saw something different. And so I said, no, I'd like to, if I may, command a Tornado station, because that was the new aeroplane in the service. And I thought it was important to see another role, and ideally perhaps something of the nuclear role, which I had no previous experience of. And so that went to the air secretary. As it happened, I got Cottesmore, which was not an operational Tornado station. And when it was announced that that was where I was going to go, I'm not sure that I wasn't slightly disappointed and wondered whether I'd made the wrong choice, because here I was going to a tri-national training establishment where, A, we didn't have an operational role, certainly not a nuclear role, and I would have to command the station in a way as primus inter pares of three colonel equivalents. There was an Italian colonello and a German Oberst there. And before I went there, the rules were that the station commander had to be at least a second tour group captain in order to be at least as experienced, probably, as his Italian and German counterparts. In my case, they broke that rule, and I was a newly appointed group captain, and the Oberst, German Oberst, had already done a tour as a station commander, as had the Italian Colonello. So, although primus inter pares in terms of authority, I was actually the least experienced in terms of age and seniority. And as I say, I sort of therefore approached it with some misgivings, I think. But at the end of the day, I actually enjoyed it. It was an interesting tour, if less satisfying than I am sure an operational station like Marham or whatever. I had vaguely hoped that I might even go to Coningsby, which was a Tornado air defence station. Because I knew that was coming up. I think that probably would have been a bit too much of a lateral move, but that was what I was vaguely hoping, so I would see a different role as well as an operational unit. But no, Cottesmore was interesting. Interesting because you did have to take into account the views of the other two nations. The Germans actually were putting more money in to Cottesmore than we were. They were receiving 46% of its output and therefore putting in 46% of its resources. We were 42%, and the final 12 or 14% or so was the Italian contribution. So clearly, you know, the Luftwaffe, through their senior national representative, certainly wanted to make sure that they were getting a fair crack of the whip in everything. My Italian Colonello was much more relaxed about life, as is the national characteristic. but frequently sort of brought some good sense and to decision making. But it did mean that you couldn't easily say, right, this is the way we're going to go. You'd have to sort of get them together and say, look, I have in mind, you know, perhaps we do this or do that, and do you think that'd be a good idea, and test it out with them. And frankly, very rarely would they actually gainsay you. They might say, well, why don't, had you thought about this one? And therefore you tended to take 2 days making a decision when normally you'd take it in 30 minutes or so. But you got to live with that, and there was a richness about the place because of the three cultures, which actually made it rather enjoyable. And I have to say, there was one or two other benefits. Because it was trinational and not an operational unit, you weren't being evaluated the whole time with people blowing the whistle at odd times of the day and night, so it was a slightly more relaxed environment. There was no shortage of money, which was interesting, because the Germans and Italians were quite prepared to pay their way, and if the Brits ever got difficult, then the German MODs would say, come on, you know, we're putting in 46%, we're putting in 12-14%, you know, come on, where's your bit of Britain? And therefore, the standard of accommodation, the emphasis placed on grounds maintenance so it looked good and things of that nature. So I actually commanded a station which was probably, apart from Cranwell, the smartest station in the Royal Air Force. And that was nice, actually, in a way, because it was at a time when barbed wire, because of the Cold War and Taco Bell and things, was increasing everywhere, so our air bases were beginning to look more and more like fortresses, which is always something that I have had a fundamental difficulty with, because it's always seemed to me that the Air Force in this country are here to defend the people of this country, but because of IRA terrorism and because of the Cold War and things of that nature, we were beginning to look as if we were defending ourselves against the local people, whereas at Cottesmore there wasn't any wire. You know, we were an open station, anybody could come on and things of that nature, and in some ways, therefore, that was really rather nice to have the smartest station and a routine that everybody, very few people didn't sort of volunteer to do a second tour or an extension at Cottesmore. So people really wanted to be there, whether they were air crew or ground crew or people in the administrative support wings and things of that nature. So it was a very happy station culturally and environmentally, from the fact that the pace of life was reasonably relaxed, although we worked hard at the job that we were doing. I mean, our job clearly just to train all three nations, four services, because we trained the German Navy, who were going on to fly Tornado as well, up to a certain point where by then they went on to do their last bit of their training nationally. The Italians went back to Gedi. The Germans either went to the German Navy or the German Air Force. Our people went on to Honington at that stage to do the next stage of Tornado training, because although we had bought a common aeroplane, by 1986 the operational fleets were starting to diverge in capability terms, and that divergence has gone on over time, so that now there isn't a great deal of commonality between a German Tornado and a British Tornado at all. It looks the same, but inside they're really quite different aeroplanes. At that stage, that divergence was not as great, but it was starting to occur, and so the next stage of training had to be done on a national basis.
Well, just for 1 second then, what do German Tornadoes and Italian Tornadoes do today?
They do the same job. They do the same job, but they've got different weapons, and therefore the cockpits look different, and so forth. Unless you put all the three different types of aeroplanes together into a single unit, but the British students only flew the British aeroplanes, the Italian students only flew the and that sort of thing, it wouldn't work, and that was just seen as not being a viable situation. Whereas at Cottesmore, because we were all flying exactly the same aeroplane, it was policy to mix the crews. So you virtually never had, in a two-seat crew, a Brit flying with a Brit or a German with a German and so forth. You always tried to mix the nationalities in the aeroplane.
With English, of course, the common language.
And English, the English, the common language, and sterling, the common currency, yes. Yeah, yeah. So they were sort of two, I suppose, in a career which has been quite a demanding one and starting to get increasingly so, this was, if you like, something of a respite. Although it was busy, There's no doubt that it was not as demanding in concentration, hours, and so forth as jobs that I'd had previously or jobs that were to happen subsequently. Carolyn might not believe that, because clearly there was quite a social responsibility of going out and meeting the local great and the good, and therefore she was quite heavily involved, and the hours were quite long for her. But for me, it was probably the most relaxed tour that I'd had in the service, other than perhaps my first tour in Singapore, which was very relaxed. So at the end of 88, I thought that the timing was such, because I was due to finish in the December of 88, that I was a natural to be picked up for the Royal College of Defence Studies in London, which is the year's course for group captains and air commodores, which prepares them for the sort of the highest level of staff appointments, so staff appointments at the 1 and 2 star level, particularly in MOD. I wanted to go and do the course, and I thought that I was probably a natural for doing so. And so I was surprised and slightly disappointed to be told that, in fact, I was going straight into the Ministry of Defence to go into the Air Plans organisation to take a group captain job which was called Air Force Programmes. There were two sides to Air Plans. There was the pure Air Plans and the Air Force Programmes, whose job it was really to marshal the bid for resources for the Air Force for the subsequent year or 4 years, to say, you know, we want to maintain so many squadrons doing this sort of flying rate, we want to bring in these new weapons and so forth. And so quite a complex task, and there's no doubt that it would have been an extremely demanding job and quite interesting. But I only actually did it for 9 months before moving on, and I'll come to that. I suppose I regretted, when I got to MOD for the first time as a group captain, regretted that I'd never been there before. I'd always fought shy of going there in the first place, because the last thing I wanted to do was to go to London and work in the Ministry of Defence. But I think actually, in hindsight, I rather wish I'd gone as a squadron leader or a wing commander and done a staff appointment in MOD, because that's the rank level to find out the structure of the MOD, to make the mistake, speak to the wrong person, embarrass yourself and things of that nature, and be able to go quietly away, learn from that mistake before you come back in at more senior rank, when errors of communication or judgment, that sort of thing, are that much more obvious. When I sort of arrived at MOD as a group captain, I rather wish I'd been there before, although I would have been disappointed to have gone there before.
And this is, I fully understand that, which is why I was slightly surprised when you tried early on in your career to avoid being an ADC to a more senior officer, because that gives you an insight into how, into what happens at that level.
Yes, it does. The reason I didn't want to be an ADC originally was, as I said, I'd only been on my first squadron for 9 months, and you know, as far as I was concerned, if I'd done 18 months on the squadron, then I would have been much less reluctant to have moved. But it seemed to me, and I hadn't long been combat ready, and here I was being dragged off my first squadron, and at the end of this tour, what credibility would I have if then, I'd be like a first tourist going on my third tour or second productive tour, and so the timing was wrong. First time. The second time they tried to ping me to be an ADC, I genuinely was about to be married. I would have gone and done the job, but he wouldn't have a married ADC, so it was his choice rather than mine that I didn't get the job.
Yeah.
Air Plans in 88, I was just really sort of settling in to the job and about to put my first program together, as it were, having done all the screening meetings and so forth, and my first experience of civil servants and the way they work the good and the bad, and some of them are really very good, very capable, competent people. Others, obviously, you know, not so good, but then I suppose that applies to all service officers. I have great respect for civil servants. I think they are extremely valuable within the Ministry of Defence because they are the corporate knowledge of the department. If that corporate knowledge is used for good purposes, then it's a huge advantage. It can be used for slightly less than good purposes if you are running a particular agenda which relies on corporate knowledge, which you recognise, I'm not going to get this past this chap, I'll give it 2 years' wait and I'll come back to it in 2 years' time and try it again. And there are undoubtedly some civil servants, not many, but some who have that sort of agenda and mental process and just bide their time and gradually build the case again if it didn't succeed the first time. But a lot of them are extremely good and very helpful.
And is that a bad thing? If they think that there is a case to be made for something and...
Well, you could argue that if the case is well made, then yes, why not? I think the only thing I would say to that is that if you didn't succeed the first time and just wait until another opportunity and try it again, then maybe if you try it 6 or 7 times, then maybe you'll get it through eventually, but that may not have been the right decision. The reason it was kicked out 5 or 6 times beforehand might have actually meant that it wasn't a good argument.
Yes, I can understand if one is having a situation where it is kicked out several times, but I was just thinking that if you have a civil servant who wants to get something through and he knows that this particular officer is not going to run with it, surely from the civil servant's point of view he will say, well, here is a man possibly with a Middleton mentality.
Possibly.
If I may put it that
possibly,
way.
Yes.
So I'll wait the 18
yeah,
months.
Yeah, and I could agree more. There are, I think, a range of possible sort of illustrations and connotations to it. But there certainly are some in the MOD who do bide their time, run an agenda item, and if it doesn't run this time, they accept something slightly less and then come back to the charge in due course. That's not to say that military officers aren't slightly paranoid about these things and always think there's an agenda going on which they would be unhappy about if they knew that it was going on. And that there's a separate line, sort of chain of communication and things of that nature. I just think, you know, occasionally these things happen. But by and large, I have found most civil servants to be very supportive of the military. But they do need the advice that military people bring to bear, because certainly in those days, less so now, because civil servants who are going to high places do now get the odd posting out of MOD as a command secretary or something of that nature to an operational command, where they do get a bit of frontline exposure, if you like. But in those days, they really didn't. They spent their whole careers, particularly if they were fast stream in the Ministry of Defence, rarely got out to see anything outside the department, so they really did need the military perspective to be brought to their attention and being told from time to time that may sound good on paper, that may make a great deal of sense in economic terms, but it just frankly will not work from a practical point of view. And you know, you may think it will, but I can tell you from my own experience, I've done it, and in most cases they will respect that and back off, and that I think is the mark of a good civil servant, someone who's got an idea, but if told it frankly will not work, will say, fine, well, let's try and do it a different way.
Sorry, I just must ask this question before this side of the tape ends. Was there much indiscipline on either side, civil or military, leaking against people within the department, briefing against?
I wasn't, at this stage of my MOD experience, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I don't think there was nearly as much leaking in 88 as there is, 15 years later the leaking has gone up for whatever reason, I'm sure it did happen, but not to the extent that it does now. And I certainly wasn't aware of people briefing against others at that stage. So no.
Right. Thank you.
So after 9 months or so in this particular job, I was then promoted to Air Commodore and got again the job which really I would love to have had, although I had made no overt sort of attempts to get it. It was exactly the job that I wanted, which was in MOD still, as the director of Air Offensive. So, if you like, from the operational policy side at the MOD level, I was responsible for all offensive forces, so Tornado, Harrier, Jaguar, all reconnaissance forces in the form of Nimrod R, Canberra, and the tactical reconnaissance assets, of course, of the other more fast jet, the maritime patrol force of Nimrod, search and rescue in terms of helicopters, and Royal Air Force Regiment, and support helicopters.